Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with Chuck Houston, 96 years old, of Fresno, California. A decorated Navy fighter pilot in World War II with VF-14 flying off the aircraft carrier USS Wasp in the Pacific. Later on, he would design architectural projects, manufacture ceramics and building materials, and of course, pump out piece after sterling piece of sculpture. His finest masterpiece, however, may just be the book Flying with Iron Angels, about all those courageous men flying off the Wasp. The last page of that book is the program from a memorial service aboard the Wasp in November 1944. From Chuck's fighter squadron alone are the names of 17 fighter pilots who never got to come home. Many of them lost at sea, their remains never recovered. Chuck, you were a 21-year-old kid dealing with the loss of your friends, and a couple of times it was pilots that you roomed with. You were the one who had to gather up their belongings. How did you handle all that emotional trauma?
I think mainly you just try to bottle it up, because it's happening over and over. You really don't get all emotional about it. You just have to close the door and bottle it up.
Is that something that developed over time, that became easier for you to deal with over time when it happened again and again?
It was always painful. You do get used to it, but it was always painful losing a friend.
And I always try to imagine what it would be like if I were in your shoes. First of all, I can't imagine being in those shoes. But is there a moment when something like that happens where you feel or hear yourself saying, that could have been me, or what if it's me next time? Did you allow yourself to have those thoughts, or did you just tune them completely out?
It was always there. You always knew from day to day and flight to flight it could end any time. So it was exciting, but you lived with it. It was something that was happening every day, and you never knew when the bad time was going to hit you.
What was the most exciting part of it for you, where you'd feel the adrenaline pumping the most?
Well, of course, nothing is much more exciting than all those big guns shooting up at you. That's quite exciting. But then you do get quick bursts of excitement with an enemy plane coming in, firing at you. So it changed from quick shots of emotion to steady drum beats of fire coming up at you.
And I imagine a lot of the things you experienced were things you were experiencing for the first time, right? That no one could tell you what to expect or prepare you for, that you just had to be ready to adjust on the fly, as they say?
You had to be ready for anything, whatever came up.
I'll go ahead and read it in your voice. I fired. My six streams of tracer bullets were surprisingly bright inside the darkness of the cloud. I fired again, and then I noticed something strange about what I was seeing. My vision was narrowing into two small circles. I looked at the thumb of my right hand holding the control stick. The thumbnail had turned blue. Most of us cut off the tip of our glove over the right thumbnail. Why'd you cut off the tip of your glove over your right thumbnail?
So we could see the condition of our blood. We could see the color changing in our thumbnail.
So these days, if you were to have to go to the hospital for any reason, one of the first things they'd do would be to slip a little thing on your thumb to measure your oxygen content. You guys were ahead of the game a few years, huh? Just cut off the tip?
That's right. We could see the color changing.
That was the World War II version of the pulse ox meter with your thumb. So, naturally, that thumbnail had turned blue. You say, I realized that I was slipping into anoxia, lack of oxygen to the brain, and suddenly I remembered I had forgotten to put on my oxygen mask as we scrambled up to high altitude. By then, we were above 20,000 feet, much too high to fly for very long without an oxygen mask. My oxygen mask was snapped to the left side of my helmet, where I usually left it hanging next to my face while flying at lower altitudes. I grabbed it, pulled it over my face, and took some fast gulps of oxygen. My vision came right back to normal. Then I went back to firing at the plane. Problem solved. Immediately, another problem popped up. The electric gun sight image that reflected up on the glass in front of me, the bullseye, burned out. I reached far forward and down to press the circuit breaker, and the light came back on. The gun sight went out, and I had to press the circuit breaker again. So I'm just picturing you, and I think the after-action report said 100 rounds you had to fire in a similar fashion. I'm guessing you didn't typically move around that much in the cockpit but here you're leaning down, you're leaning back up. That sounds ridiculous. Did it feel a little ridiculous?
Yeah, it is ridiculous, all right, yeah. But you had a lot of things to do in that cockpit, moving around and moving your hands and your feet.
But every time we think the story's over, and I love your writing style here, it's not quite over yet. So here you say, our landing signal officer had been landing me for the previous 8 or 9 months, and I had rarely received a wave off from him, so I was sure he had enough confidence in me by then to let me come in a little bit high. But surprise, he gave me a wave off, and I had to pour on the gas to go around for another approach, and I had no gas to spare. By this time, with all the gun sight problems, my anoxia problem, and the fatigue from the 5-hour combat air patrol, I was running out of steam and was in a rotten mood, and I was thinking about some wild thoughts about those dirty buggers down on the Wasp. They would just be sorry when I ran out of gas and crashed into the fantail. But in spite of my abnormal mental state, I came around in a deliberately normal landing approach, got a normal cut, landed and taxied forward and parked. I sat there, totally exhausted, finally climbed out and walked slowly across the deck toward the catwalk. Suddenly, the bullhorn up on the island structure blared out, Lieutenant Houston, walking across the flight deck, has just shot down a Jap plane attacking our fleet. The hundreds of crewmen all around the flight deck and all the officers and men looking down from the island broke into loud cheering and clapping. All at once, I was no longer so exhausted. A little public acclaim is so intoxicating.
Oh, yes, right. Everything changed then. Everything was on the upbeat.
Over the loudspeaker, they say your name, say that you just shot down an enemy plane, and who knows, maybe saved the lives of some guys aboard that plane could have hurt. What does that feel like inside when you hear that announcement and all those guys are cheering for you?
You know what a hero you are. Pretty exciting.
You're writing of another one here. A big day for the Iron Angels. October 15th, 1944. The Japanese tried a daylight raid with 60 to 80 planes, maybe even more than 100, and VF-14 shot down 30 and a half of them. I'm just going to read some of this and see what it stirs up for you. In the first turn, I looked straight up through my canopy and saw a Zero coming across the circle, making a full deflection, 90-degree run on me. Just before his guns flashed, I whipped the stick to the right and rotated up as the Zero fired, and I felt the thump of his cannon shell hitting the tail of my plane and exploding. That doesn't sound like a good feeling.
No, that's a bad feeling when you feel the explosion hit your plane.
How do you assess the damage in a situation like that?
Well, you don't assess it because you can't see anything back there. You just keep flying.
Keep your fingers crossed and hope the plane doesn't do anything funny?
Well, you don't cross your fingers. They're on the stick.
So you continue. We were then in a swirling ball of airplanes in a great circle, each of us shooting at a Zeke, which was shooting at a Hellcat, which was after another Zeke. I got one Zero and then came in behind another who zoomed almost straight up as I fired. He just kept going up, but didn't burn or fall apart as I fired, and I finally lost flying speed and dropped off. I was sure the pilot must have been dead in the cockpit, but I never claimed him as a probable. So that right there could have been your ace status.
Sure, could have been.
But that wasn't your priority in the moment.
No, priority is just keep the fight going and try to survive.
And you're right, the whole fight was over in about 2 minutes. It was fast and wild, and it soon looked like we had run out of enemy planes. Then I saw one flying away from the action, and I went after him with Larry Dewing flying slightly behind me. This Zero pilot made the mistake of not putting his nose down and heading straight away from me. Instead, he made a hard right, nose-down turn across my flight path. I had a difficult, full deflection shot at him, far out in front of me, so I set my gun sight bullseye way, way out in front of him, and gave him a long burst. He kept going down and finally hit the water. So that's, if I'm reading this correctly, because you had said you'd gotten another earlier, then you had one you didn't claim as a probable, but it sounds like in those short 2 minutes, you shot down 3 enemy planes?
Yeah, that's right. It all happened fast.
And they didn't shoot you down?
Fortunately, they didn't do it.
But they came close enough. You say, when I taxied forward, I felt something unusual with my tail wheel. The tail was just dragging along the deck. I already knew that the Zero's hit on my plane had damaged my arresting hook because I had to manually lower it. When I got out of my plane and inspected it a few minutes later, I realized how lucky I was to have gotten back to the Wasp. That Zero's 20-millimeter shell had gone into the left side of my fuselage just ahead of the tail surfaces. Where it went in on the left side was a clean 2-inch hole, but after it exploded inside, it came out the right side and made a jagged hole 2 feet in diameter. Even worse, the wire cables to the rudder and elevator controls were cut and just barely holding together. It was impossible to repair such major damage, so my plane was pushed over the side of the ship. But it had brought me safely back home. This sounds like some made-up story. This is not the way it's supposed to work. So that 20-millimeter shell almost killed you, almost took you out.
Almost. That was closer than you want it to be, yeah.
And when I asked you, how do you assess the damage, you said, you can't. Maybe that was a good thing? Maybe it was helpful not to know what kind of shape your plane was in?
Oh, yeah, you might as well not know until you get safely back to the carrier.
And I don't want to misinterpret either, because I didn't fly Hellcats. I don't know how it all works. But I'm just kind of inferring from all that, that if that shell had been an inch or two in one direction or another, it might have ended differently?
Oh, yes, it could have ended very differently. I would have been down in the water.
And you write there that the wire cables to the rudder and elevator controls were cut and just barely holding together. So if they'd been severed completely, you wouldn't have been able to control the plane back in?
No control, and I'd have just gone in the water.
You wouldn't have had time to do anything but that.
Well, maybe time to jump out of the plane and pull the ripcord, maybe. It's sad to see your plane shoved over, but of course at that time the plane, it's useless. It's all shot up, so you might as well get rid of it. Makes you feel very lucky to have made it, very lucky. In the heat of combat, you're just thinking about what you're doing right then, not thinking about tomorrow or anything else along the side. There was an aspiring to stay alive and to get to the next battle, but no great desire to be an ace or anything like that. I was one of the youngest pilots in the Navy.
And there's a story in your book where you and another pilot, Joe Doherty, because you're both younger and single, conspire to take the 2 planes available that day and keep your friend Don Gruber from flying because he was married and had a newborn. It describes how the two of you even rigged a coin flip to ensure Gruber wouldn't fly that day. That happened July 4th, 1944, and on the 75th anniversary, here a couple months ago, you received a note from Gruber's family thanking you, because the reality is he would have been killed. He would have been flying the plane Doherty flew and been in the same spot. Doherty, of course, did not come back from that mission. You did, and you said earlier that this happened enough that you almost got used to it and you managed those emotions. But I see the emotion and gratitude from the Gruber family that you and Joe were willing really to trade your lives for his. So I read about Doherty's death or your roommate Al Lorraine who didn't come back from another one of your missions. And what I wonder is, over all this time, and it took hours and hours and really years of your life to put this book together, did you ever find yourself imagining about Al, Joe, whomever, here's the kind of life he would have led if he had made it home safely?
Oh, yes, there's always that thought. Wonderful young men, their lives were cut short while they were still young men. I look back with great fondness on those good friends.
And there is another story along those lines that we're going to talk about when we come back. A lifelong friend and former college football teammate who would be awarded the Navy Cross for a heroic decision that would cost him his life. We'll hear about it from 96-year-old Chuck Houston when we come back. I know I've said it a time or two, and you're hearing it for yourself when I read some of these passages, but this book is amazing, Flying with Iron Angels. And that name, Iron Angels, there's a story there. There's an insignia there, and it has Chuck Houston's name all over it. We'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.